our heart, the sky's above us, so we've got a very daily connection with those things. And of course, if you're looking at them more metaphorically, that we've still got our bodies and our emotions and our minds. So I'm not exactly sure what the question is about. Or is it more just the question about you're having a particular kind of experience and we're practicing on the retreat and getting into a relationship with those things, and how do you maintain that afterwards? Do you want to say a bit more about the question, actually? I suppose I find ordinary experience versus retreat experience, and particularly in this situation where we're all at home and probably still engaging in a lot of our ordinary activities, maybe that can provide a bit of a bridge. And I would say practice, really, meditation practice and all our other practice provides the bridge for me. I don't, what you think, Paramananda?
Suppose what I was beginning to think was trusting that actually what we're sort of trying to move to, I mean, I have said this in a way, is remembering this is having this relationship with the world. I think in the first poem that Derek Walcott, he sort of talks about it as a birthright. It is a natural state, I mean, it might sound a bit hippie or something, but actually, whenever I go to Rivendell, if anybody's been there, I always make sure I go. I've got this tradition in that part of England where they've left or planted a lot of oaks in the middle of fields that are presumed to provide shelter for the cattle or the sheep or grain from those fields. And you see those trees, and they just belong, they're naturally in the world. And I think what we're trying to do, and I think it is a It's an undoing, we're trying to undo something, return to some natural, when you use this word natural, this way of being in the world, which is just natural to us, really. I think most people can get a sense of it as, if you, I mean, this is not perhaps true for everybody, but I think it's true for most people, at least in part. You can probably remember a time when you were a child when the world was just magical. And of course, the world hasn't stopped being magical. It's just that we've dulled ourselves to that magic. We've dulled ourselves to the kind of mysterious, magical, enchanted nature of the world, and so I think the bridge in a way is, James Hillman, what talks about soul in the city, is defined soul in our everyday life, whether that's in how you cook and eat, or how you handle objects, or how you arrange your meditation cushion, or how you dress. You can find this sort of soul in everything, actually. This is so. I'm not suggesting it's easy because there's a lot working against it, but it is quite possible. So I think one way of looking at meditation is just a space where we remind ourselves that this is what we want to do. We want to live in a creative relationship with the world. This is our longing. I think I was saying that yesterday, wasn't our basic longing to be part of the world. I don't know if that helps. haven't really got time to go into this on this retreat in detail, but I think it's quite right that both the heart and the gut, as they've found, haven't they, even physiologically, that, you know, neuro tissue is spread right through. So, I mean, even science now is starting to talk about having kind of three brains, that's the language they use, you know, one in the gut and one in the heart and one in the head, you know, and obviously in a sense the gut is the most primitive, because, you know, the early life is just basically a feeding tube, isn't it? So the heart develops later, and of course the brain develops a lot later in evolutionary terms. So I think gut feelings are more or less the taste of the world, you know. It's very, very, it's more or less. So, you know, in a way, we're talking about, I mean, it's interesting about, of course, you can't always trust the heart. Yeah, you know, that's the thing about the heart, you know. And I think you can only trust the heart when it is actually linked both down into the gut, which is this real basic instinctual taste of things in a way, and also linked up to the rationality. I mean, we've got to be a bit careful. I don't want to denigrate rationality. You know, it's when they're working together, when there's a sort of fluidity, that in communication with each other, that we begin, I think, to be able to trust. But I would say, because, and again, I don't know how literally, I'm not suggesting you take this literally necessarily, but I do think you can imagine the heart as a ruling centre, because it's the middle way between the sort of instinctual and the intellectual. So the heart itself is a bridge between the sort of two extremes, if you like, you know. But of course, all of this is just a way of speaking, you know. I don't want people to take it too literally. And I think it's right that on a physiological level, you know, not to put it crudely, but if you're really scared, of course, you shit yourself, you know, you literally shit yourself. Anybody's been really scared, they will know that. So it is that part of the body that responds to fear most, is most sensitive to that sort of basic danger, you know. So yes, you know, the gut, we need to also take notice of the gut, you know. And of course, you know, now it's interesting how much eating disorders are in the world these days. You know, it's interesting that animals don't, animals in their natural environment do not overeat, and they know what to eat instinctively. Yeah, it's nothing, they don't have to have dietary books. So they, you know, this is a, you don't get obese animals in the natural environment. They know what to eat. And some animals, you know, eat an amazing variety of different things. And, you know, this is a knowledge, which is a knowledge, it's an intelligence, but it's an intelligence probably associated with the gut more than anything else. Anyway, I don't know if that helps. Fear, I think, is often an underlying, such an interesting, I don't know that I'm reluctant to sort of get involved in fear. It's such a sort of rich area, actually, fear, yes. But yes, it's probably mainly experience of below. But it is this basic, I mean, the base chakra, if you want to talk in these terms, is our basic. Well, the two lower chakras are this basic kind of survival stuff is going on. You know, basic survival stuff going on down there.
And I think, yeah, it's and fear is such a big area. Yes, Beardarkwa, I would agree that fear limits creativity. I think it limits thought. I think it limits all kinds of things. If we get into defending about it and reacting or identifying with it and getting caught up in it. I know I spent years in sort of constant state of fear and existential terror, and little things would just tip me right into it, you know, just very mundane little things, and I'd just go into it. That doesn't happen so much now. It does occasionally. So I think for me, there's been lots of things that have helped me with that, which include counselling and which include body work, and particularly include getting a Dharmic perspective on things. And through practice, actually, it's like you can understand something in your head intellectually, and sometimes you can understand it emotionally, and then sometimes you can have like an insight experience that just cuts through everything, and then you just, I suppose, you cut through to reality, and then you realize it, and then there's a lot of letting go. So that was one of the things that eventually helped me with that level of fear and terror. And I know it was on a retreat at Tararoka, where we're doing a lot of Satipatthana and Anapanasati practice, you know, led by Sadanandi and Vidyamala. And during an Upekkha Bhavana, I remember having, you know, doing some reflections and just cutting through and seeing through a lot of my views. And it was a very strong experience on that retreat. And I thought, when I get better, well, I'll just go back to everything, but I never did. And for weeks and months, it was like, I didn't know how I was going to respond in any situation, because I was so used to being in this state of fear and reacting out of fear, and that underlying constant fear wasn't there anymore. But I think in terms, yes, I think meditation practice can hold some fear, and sometimes it can't really. So I think we have to see where we're at with it. And I'm just thinking back to the Buddha, and is it the Abhayavaha Sutta, the Fear and Dread Sutta. I mean, I always find that reassuring, that the Buddha himself experienced fear and dread, and also Papancha, about whether or not he was going to feel fear and dread when he was meditating alone in the forest in these scary places. And, you know, what he decided was that if the fear and dread came upon him, he would just sit with it. If he was sitting or standing, if he was standing, you know, if he was lying down, walk with it. So wherever it came, he would just be with it. And I think in some ways that's what we have to do. And I think for me, certainly when I've got very strong feelings, and it's a bit hard just being in the emotions or the thoughts, if I come back to the body, and where am I feeling it in the body? You know, for me, fear, I often feel along, you know, my spine and in my back, and I'm not always conscious that I'm feeling fear, and then I touch into my body and then I realize I'm feeling fear. But if I am aware of it and I just actually go with the sensations and what's it like moment by moment experiencing fear in my body, that can help ground it. But obviously that's just what works for me, and it might not work for you.
So I just wanted to say, of course, you know, fear is also functionally important. You know, it's important that we appropriately feel fear at certain times. As part of our survival. I mean, the trouble is, as Bodhidharma was describing, if it becomes habitual, then of course, I mean, it's interesting with this all this trembling trauma release stuff you get now, and they use the example of animals, don't they? If a deer is chased and escapes, once it's out of danger, it trembles and trembles. And it dissipates, it dissipates it from the body, so it doesn't hold it. So, and even as young children, you know, our emotions, our bodies immediately process emotion. I think somewhere, depending on what's happened to us as children, or sometimes in puberty, at different points in the life, in our life, particularly. I don't know if it is particularly men, but men repress, that was big, perhaps a bit more for men than I can for women. You know, it's very common for men to repress crying or that, and so they inhibit these natural ways in which fear is dissipated, or not just fear, but that might be an example. You know, so I think it, again, in a way, it's learning to, it's learning how, it's relearning, it's remembering, or it's allowing the body to naturally process these emotions, which are not necessarily bad in and of themselves. As I say, you know, sometimes it's very useful to be afraid. You know, some people that don't, you know, only psychopaths don't really have any fear. Well, I don't know about that, but I don't know. But you know what I mean? You know, it's a normal part of our emotional equipment.
Yeah, I think it's, you know, when it's appropriate. And I think especially if we've experienced trauma, and young children, we know that if they experience trauma, it has an effect on what is set as the default in the physiological body, you know, and you might have very high levels of cortisol and be almost on permanently on that hypersensitive spectrum. And I think as adults, we can, you know, if we're suffering PTSD, that also happens. And I also think there's something about, while the body responds to fear by releasing all these particular hormones like adrenaline and cortisol, and if we're not running away like a deer and shaking, then that stays in the body and keeps on having an effect. And often what triggers us now, the body doesn't distinguish between, you know, if we've got the threat of, you know, a tiger eating us, or whether it's that we've got an appraisal from our boss the next day, it'll respond in the same way. And there are so many mundane things that can trigger those responses, and then, you know, it remains in our body, and we do need to find ways of working with that. Anyway, I don't think we've got time to say any more at this point, but thank you all very much for coming again, and moving into Sky tomorrow. So I hope to see you there. Anything else you wanted to say, Paramananda or Pandita?
Up and away.
Yeah.